Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Tuesday, December 2nd. Let's see. Currently, we've got 24 degrees in Old Town Park City. Heber City reporting 26 degrees under mostly cloudy skies. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Tuesday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back. As we go throughout your Tuesday, look for mostly cloudy skies throughout most of the day. Temperatures will remain on the chilly side, with high temperatures only climbing into the mid-30s for us. In the Park City area, we'll see those highs climbing into the low 40s here as we get towards the Heber Valley. Now, as we go into this afternoon, into this evening, we'll see a chance of snow showers developing across the Wasatch Back. Those snow showers will be scattered across the area, increasing a little bit more as we get towards the late evening hours. And with temperatures dropping well below freezing, some of that could create some light accumulations for us overnight Tuesday heading into early Wednesday morning. Temperatures will dip down to around 20 degrees to kick off your Wednesday morning. So yeah, anything that has fallen overnight into early Wednesday morning will likely accumulate, creating some light accumulations. Now, the system overall has trended drier as it moves our way, so we're not looking at any blockbuster snowfall amounts. In fact, snowfall amounts, I think, still averaging around that 1 to 3 inch range there for us for most of the Wasatch Back. But as again, we'll keep an eye on that. But for the most part, looks like this will be a fairly light event. But hey, at least it's a nice duster for us to continue adding to some of the landscape out there. Temperatures will remain on the chilly side, though, as we go throughout the day on your Wednesday, with highs only in the mid-30s in the Heber Valley. We'll see those highs only around 30 degrees in Park City. As you get towards your Friday, look for a mixture of sun and clouds for your Thursday and Friday. But by Friday afternoon, those clouds really start to ramp back up, and a chance of accumulating snow arrives again for us as we go into your Friday evening into Friday night. That'll continue into your Saturday in Park City, with temperatures remaining in the 30s for highs and lows in the 20s. In the Heber Valley, we'll see that chance of a rain-snow mix developing for your Friday afternoon, and that could continue into your Saturday as well, with temperatures dipping down into the 20s and highs in the low 40s. That's a look at your latest forecast with the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
To start our Utah Avalanche Center forecast reports, Nikki did make it in. Nikki, good morning.
Good morning. Welcome to the 2025 winter. We're going to start being on the radio every day, and we're going to start issuing daily danger ratings on our website as well. So if you haven't been checking those out, now is a good time to start. Overall, things have been generally quiet in the backcountry. We don't have a ton of coverage. Most of the snow is isolated to north-facing aspects above mid and upper elevation, so above 8,500 feet. Yesterday, we did have a few avalanche reports trickle in the Alta zone. You might have heard that there was a animal-triggered soft slab on High Rustler at Alta. That was on a north-facing aspect above 9,700 feet. And there was also some reports of soft slabs of wind-drifted snow in the Catherine Pass area. Today, the main thing we want to think about is that persistent snow, so that persistent weak layer. We had a few small storms in October and November. What that did is leave weak faceted snow at the upper elevation north-facing slopes. Currently, it's not a huge issue. The main concern today is going to be any areas that hold that old snow and received a bit of wind, but that is going to become an issue moving forward. So as we get additional snow or wind, the avalanche danger will increase.
Okay. Hey, this is the first time I'd heard of an animal-triggered avalanche. Any idea if the animal was okay?
We're not sure. We get a few reports of avalanche or animal-triggered avalanches each year. You can kind of see what we think are coyote tracks, like scurrying into the avalanche and likely scurrying out. But overall, it was a pretty small avalanche. And there's no signs to believe that the avalanche or the animal wasn't okay. So I think you made it out of there.
Okay. All right, Nikki. Hey, thanks. And we'll talk to you over the winter.
Yeah, sounds good.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up, I'll be checking in with Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh with a preview of this week's county council meeting. Later on, the executive director of Holy Cross Ministries, Emmy Gardner, with details of the upcoming International Migrants Day and a review of immigration this year in America. And finally, executive director of Utah Open Lands, Wendy Fisher, discusses open space issues, including Clark Ranch. Well, a bankrupt Colville Resort's main lender wants to auction the resort off by March. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports a local billionaire and some homeowners have characterized the lending scheme as a green card scam.
The U.S. Bankruptcy Court in the District of Utah is deliberating on the future of the Wahali Resort in Colville after hearing 10 hours of debate over 3 days before Thanksgiving. Wahali filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protections in August to restructure at least $100 million in debts. Although some companies successfully create new business plans after going Chapter 11, Wahali may be sold instead. Bankruptcy Judge Peggy Hunt has appointed businessman Matt McKinley as the trustee to manage the resort during its bankruptcy. He's now seeking a court-approved loan to preserve Wahali's golf course and any other assets and then set up a sale by March next year. Wahali's largest and most mysterious creditor wants to lend McKinley the money. It's a group of non-residents using the federal government's EB-5 immigrant investor program. The program allows lenders to get a visa or green card if they invest enough money and create at least 10 jobs. Some people who bought home sites in Wahali and Doug Bergeron, a Park City billionaire, object to EB-5's loan terms and each propose their own. Bergeron and the Wahali lot owners accuse the EB-5 lenders of trying to leverage their status as the most important creditors to buy the resort for cheap at a, quote, fire sale in March. The lot owner's attorney, Jason Harden, told the judge November 24th he thinks there should be more investigation.
We think we're going to be able to ultimately prove, inequitable conduct on the part of EB-5.
Harden's clients claim the foreign lenders carelessly lent money to Wahali so that they could get the maximum number of visas without making sure the money was well spent. Brokers estimate Wahali's value ranges from $50 million to $150 million. McKinley says there are already 6 interested buyers. His attorney, Ellen Ostro, says it's rare for a bankrupt business to have so many loan offers, but that EB-5 is still offering the best deal.
Your Honor, we have received multiple complaints about EB-5's pre-petition conduct and actions, and the trustee has taken those seriously and has run those to ground.
Hunt says she will review the competing loan terms before issuing a ruling. Wahali's next date in bankruptcy court is Wednesday, December 3rd. According to McKinley's attorney, Wahali had 55 employees as of September 2025, mostly for the golf course. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, the Wasatch County Council meets Wednesday starting at 4 o'clock and is set to hold a public hearing and possibly approve next year's budget. On the phone with a preview of the meeting is County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Good morning, Dustin.
Good morning, Leslie.
So let's start with the budget and the council's discussion a few weeks ago about the sheriff's office funding request. The sheriff's asked for $2.2 million in new funding. How much of that request will the county grant?
I think right now the discussions have been largely that the council's comfortable with the recommendations that we presented in the tentative budget, so all of them.
Okay. Sheriff Jared Rigby had shared some statistics with the council about 911 calls, other calls for service arrests, and traffic stops. Anything stand out to you in those stats?
I think, to me, they help make a case that the changes that we're proposing are warranted and that this is a wise use of taxpayer funds to ensure that we're adequately addressing public safety needs.
Mm-hmm. So is the majority of that $2.2 million for new hires?
There are 9 new positions that are presented in the budget for the sheriff's office. So much of that funding goes to there.
All right. And how does it determine the priority of those new personnel? I mean, if you were not to fund them all.
Yeah. So we actually asked the sheriff when he originally proposed his budget request to prioritize his recommendations. So these actually don't represent all of the things that he asked for. These are just the ones that we thought were the highest priority and ones that we could afford in the budget. So we talked with him about those prioritizations of which positions were most needed, and we presented those to the council basically in that order with the understanding that if they wanted to make changes to it, there are some complexities with individual positions, like, for instance, the school resource officers. We actually get outside funding associated with that, so maybe some of those might not be as high priority, but they also don't represent a straight savings to the county.
Okay. Any idea how Wasatch County compares to other Utah counties and its funding allegations for a sheriff's office?
Yeah, we actually did an examination and found that Wasatch County is about 15th or 16th when you look at it in terms of percentage of the general fund and per capita spending on public safety for counties. I think we feel comfortable that we're kind of in that middle of the pack. And while this represents an increase in spending, that comparison is actually kind of last year's data comparing to this year's proposal. So I think we'll stay relatively close to the middle of that pack, given this change.
And what about overtime funding for the sheriff's office as well as other county employees? I mean, does the county spend more on overtime than other Utah counties?
We haven't actually been able to get all of the detail, I think, from a broad enough swath of other counties to tell exactly where we sit there. I think this last year, certainly, I think we were among high users just because we have had a high number of vacancies and needing to cover shifts in the sheriff's office means that we need more overtime to be able to do that. But we've been able to do it within the existing budget because we had those vacancies. We're able to use those funds to cover the costs of those overtime expenses.
All right. Also, a public hearing for the salary increases for county employees. What is that cost of living adjustment?
So the county is proposing a 3% cost of living adjustment. And this is across the board for all county employees, including the elected and appointed officials. This is actually a required public hearing from state code, I believe effective last year, just to make sure that the public has transparency on how any of these higher level compensations are changing.
And is that enough to keep pace with inflation?
So we did a comparison, I believe it was October to October, and found that there was about a 3% increase. Social Security is going up by 2.75%. That typically lags behind other cost of living indexes. And so we feel like it's justified. There are many other municipal entities that did a 3% increase mid-year. So we feel like it is adequate, and we want to remain competitive, but we also don't want to unnecessarily increase costs to taxpayers when we don't feel like we can justify it.
Yeah. Any idea how many county employees commute in from another county?
I don't have the numbers on hand, but we have a fair amount. I would say somewhere in the range of, a third to half of our employees are in that area of commuting. And this is something that we're seeing kind of a growing trend that it's getting harder and harder for people to afford housing up here. Which is one of the reasons why we're trying to work with Heber City and other entities to push some more affordable housing options, which we are making a little bit of progress on.
Yeah. And in terms of transit, did you add anything to maybe expand the transit options for, especially for commuters?
Yeah, so we actually largely maintained the transit offerings. We have a fixed bus route that connects between Heber City and Park City, and maintain our paratransit, which services people with qualified disabilities, and our microtransit. There is some increased costs associated just with inflationary costs as the price of fuel changes and other things. So, but no, not really significant changes in our transit offerings.
All right. Anything else you wanted to mention about the budget?
No, I think other than maybe that there are some significant changes in there, primarily related to some capital expenditures. We're planning on using some savings for our Edmond Building construction project. So there are some big ticket items in there that are one-time items. So if people have questions about why there are some of these big changes, those are usually what's driving those.
Okay, and so you anticipate the budget being adopted tomorrow? Because I'm not sure if you've got any more meetings scheduled.
Yeah, so we do have a meeting scheduled on the third Wednesday of this month. In the last few years, the council has adopted the budget following this public hearing. I expect that they likely will. They've been largely comfortable with the discussions we've been having around the budget. I expect we'll also have a little bit of discussion about the Parks and Recreation budget, which that public hearing, because they're a special service district, will actually be next week, on next Tuesday. So we may talk a little bit about it in this because it has a relationship with the county's budget on how the county is contributing funding towards Parks and Recreation. And ultimately, we'll have some more discussion about that probably on Wednesday as well as next Tuesday.
Okay. Moving on, it's been a while since the county's talked about a conservation easement for the Lundin Farm. So what's up for consideration this week?
Yeah, so this is, I think, a recent development. The county's been really consistent and really wanting to see this property get preserved. I think there have been some unique complexities associated with the property due to, some family circumstances and others related to the property. I believe what's being proposed now is a little bit of a shift from what we've done in the past, in that there was kind of a more complicated exchange of collateral because of, again, the complexities of the situation. What we're looking to do now is actually emulate what we did with the Allen Giles conservation easement that actually went in earlier this year or late last year, where the county fronts some money, where we end up being county and Midway City would be the first money in, with the intent of trying to ensure that the property is able to be closed in a reasonable amount of time to get a conservation easement. And so it would be on the same grounds that either the county would get the money back or the conservation easement would go into place, regardless of what other funding comes in.
Okay. So what, I guess, how much funding is the county providing for the easement?
Yeah, so the original ask that the council largely was supportive of was $2 million from Wasatch County and $1 million from Midway, that $3 million being some of that initial money that they were hoping to clear all of the issues associated with the property so that they could proceed with the conservation easement.
All right, and the total value of the easement then? Is it?
I believe that it was a $10 million estimate. The county has typically contributed 20% of the conservation value. And so that $2 million represents 20% of that $10 million valuation.
So does it, is it coming together? Have we finalized all of the terms?
You know, this is a very recent development, something that I only became aware of last week. Mm. And so I don't know exactly if every I has been dotted and T has been crossed, but I think we're making meaningful progress. So I'm hoping to learn more information myself at Wednesday's meeting. I know that the applicants are planning on coming and others are coming to kind of speak in behalf, including Utah Open Lands, to see if we can't get this property tied up in a conservation easement in perpetuity.
Okay. Will there be any public access to the land once that easement's finalized?
I believe that there was a component originally proposed on the hillside portion of it for a trailhead and other access across that portion of it, but that the farm area would not have public access.
All right. Moving on, the county will also be discussing an easement for Jordan L. Ridge. Some local leaders and conservation experts were critical of the last draft of the Jordan L. Ridge agreement. What changes have been made to this?
Yeah, so this new draft incorporates some feedback provided by the Summit Land Conservancy. When we met with some stakeholders associated with that, they provided, I think, a few recommendations that were relatively easy to incorporate. So we've been working with the other two parties. So this is Wasatch County working with Heber City and the underlying property owner to ensure that, you know, the term of the agreement was set to last in perpetuity, and just to make that more clear, as well as to set specific conservation values and state that this easement is intended to protect those conservation values. There were a couple of recommendations from Summit Land Conservancy that were not incorporated, and so I think we'll discuss that a little bit about Wasatch County's comfort level with, you know, what changes have been made. I think that there are also provisions in there that may need to be a little bit cleaned up. So our staff report actually recommends that we need to look, this agreement needs a little bit more work before I think it's ready to be adopted.
So we're still talking about the easement being held by local government and the landowner as opposed to a land trust?
Yeah, that is the proposal that Heber City worked out with the landowners and has thus far allowed Wasatch County to be a party to.
Okay, so no changes anticipated in that item?
No, I don't expect that to change.
Hmm. All right. The agreement was intended to be held jointly with Heber City. So have you weighed in on that new draft?
Yeah, we provided some feedback to them around some specific provisions. There were some language that we felt like needed to be clarified better. And there's a new provision that allows, kind of addresses the situation that if the HOA, who would be the underlying property owner, if they default on property taxes, what happens in those circumstances? And we felt like Wasatch County's role in that circumstance could maybe be enhanced a little bit to ensure that the property is protected in all cases.
All right. And when do you anticipate that easement gets finalized?
You know, I hope that after our meeting on Wednesday, we can resolve any of those outstanding issues and engage the council's comfort level. I think it's possible they could approve it at our following meeting in December 13th. That'll be contingent on really my council's, kind of opinions of the current status of that agreement and if Heber City and the property owner also are amenable to the changes that we're proposing.
All right. And any other conservation easements you're working on right now?
You know, there are a number that are in progress. I'm not aware of any new applications that we've received, but like the Pear Tree Llama application was one that we've processed and approved out in kind of the Midway area, and among some others that I think largely Utah Open Lands has been trying to work with the National Resource Conservation Service to secure the federal funding portion of those, and that's been a little volatile last little bit. So,
okay. Wanted to ask you the fact that we've seen 8 confirmed cases of measles so far in Wasatch County. Do you anticipate, or what are you hearing, any more cases emerging now after the holiday?
You know, I haven't heard an updated report from the health department. I know they put out notification to the public just to make them aware that there's this issue. So if people who aren't vaccinated or are immunocompromised, that they have all the information necessary. So if they did want to stay home from school and reduce their risk of infection, they could do that. But I've not heard any updates specifically on changes there.
All right. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, I don't think so.
All right. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
That's Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybow. Today is Giving Tuesday. Thursday, December 18th, it's International Migrants Day. In the studio with details on both, I have the Executive Director of Holy Cross Ministries, Emmy Gardner, along with the Director of Development and Communications, Andy Sear. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's see, Giving Tuesday, held on the Tuesday after Thanksgiving in the United States, kind of touted as a global generosity movement, unleashing the power of radical generosity. It also falls just a month after Park City's Live PC, Give PC. Is Holy Cross Ministry participating in both?
Yes, we do, but we in Summit County, we kind of play it a little bit quieter just because we have just asked a lot of our supporters for help during Live PC, Give PC, and people were great this year. We reached our goal. We had a lot of new donors. And I want to today make it Giving Thanks Tuesday, because we're just super thankful to the support we have from Wasatch County and Summit County.
All right, so you recognize the fact that there may come a point where nonprofits just ask too often, especially it won't be long before we start getting those letters, you know, year-end giving letters.
Exactly, and people, there's a thing called donor fatigue, and I think people in Park City feel it, but we are also very thankful to our donors, and we know that this time of year is a time when people give, and it's also a time when there's a lot of need in our community and elsewhere.
Yeah, so it sounds like it's been actually a pretty good year fundraising-wise for Holy Cross Ministries this year.
You know, it has, but we're looking at next year, and what's happened a lot is that because of the government cuts in government funding, it's had this cascading effect on nonprofits and on private foundations. So a lot of private foundations are stepping in to fill the gap, and they're stretched super thin. So we've definitely seen that. Even though the stock market is up and has helped those foundations at the same time, everyone is asking them for money because they've got to make up for that loss of government funding.
Yeah. And in terms of any money raised then for Giving Tuesday today, that just goes into general budget next year?
Yes, absolutely. And we're looking at a flat next year or down just because of that. We're really worried about, we're just getting signals and signs from foundations and from funders. And, you know, there's a kind of a shadow on the horizon. Amy could probably speak to that better.
In terms of the Fiesta 150 event that you had in October, how'd that go?
Actually, that was amazing. We want to thank all of our sponsors and our donors and our folks that did the tables. And we actually surpassed our goal. We had a goal of $150,000, and we went over $200,000. So we are super thankful to Salt Lake community and the Wasatch Front and Wasatch Back community. Park City folks came down on the bus, and we had a great event down at the University of Utah this year.
And I think it was just an amazing tribute to the sisters and their amazing legacy here in the Wasatch Front and, you know, in the Wasatch Back.
Right.
Yeah, so that was kind of our intent. Yes, it was great we made money, but I think it was really just to honor this amazing legacy of their social justice in our community.
Yeah, how many sisters are left?
Oh,
not many.
Yeah, around 450. Then that's international. Yeah, no, that's throughout the world. So they're in 7 countries on 4 continents.
All right. Holy Cross Ministries operates out of Salt Lake. How much of their work is done here in Summit County?
Oh my gosh, I would say close to 40% of our work is here as well as down there. I mean, we're statewide. It's actually just not. And so all of our pillars, our justice, our health, our education, all, you know, function up here. Exclusively our education pillar is up here with our school readiness and our Parents as Teachers program. But our DOJs come up to Peace House and do, you know, screenings for folks for U visas. We have a prima torta that's at the People's Health Clinic. We have one going on 2 mental health therapists that are here in the Wasatch back expressly supporting our underserved community, both here in Summit County and in Wasatch County.
All right.
So yeah. So just definitely still very much a commitment to the Wasatch back.
Okay. So you do work in Wasatch County as well?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. What we found post-COVID is that so much of the clients that we served, you know, out migrated because they can't afford to live in Park City anymore. And so we have a strong presence. Our therapist is a day a week at the library at Heber. She's at the Weber High School and seeing kids at the high school and the junior high. Also at Peace House. And then also seeing clients remotely that are Heber residents or Wasatch County residents from People's Health Clinic.
All right. You mentioned the organization's pillars. What are those?
So the sisters, when they founded Holy Cross Ministries, kind of, you know, did this listening tour of the immigrant community and really kind of settled on what were the services that the immigrant community needed. And so that's what created these 3 pillars: health, education, and justice. So really trying to empower folks with knowledge and education opportunities, especially women and kids, right? And then as, you know, they were doing this work for like 4 or 5 years, then added that justice pillar when they realized that so many needed a pathway to citizenship. So yeah.
Okay. Well, as I mentioned in the introduction, Thursday, the 18th of December, International Migrants Day. Why is that meaningful to Holy Cross Ministries?
You know, again, as a sponsored ministry of the sisters, while we don't have any sisters working with us anymore, but, you know, they founded our organization 30 years ago, the sisters actually do have a corporate stand on migration, and they've had that since 2019. And their belief is that, you know, it's war, violence, unemployment, environmental disasters, cultural or religious persecution that are just some of those factors that cause mass kind of movements, you know. And so it's again this piece of how do we stand in solidarity with our, you know, with humans who are fleeing whatever sort of situation that is. We come from a place of assuming good intent that most people want to stay where they are, right? They want to be in their culture and their language and their foods and all of that, but that for whatever reason they need to leave. And so part of our call, so to speak, right, is to stand with them and the migrants and refugees and really see what we can do to help them on their journey to having a better life.
And I kind of looked in some of the numbers real quickly, and we have seen a steep decrease in unauthorized migration at the U.S.-Mexico border, about 444,000 this year compared to like 2.1 million last year. As a result of less focus on the border now, what we're seeing is immigration enforcement within the interior of the United States. So why is it that so many fewer people are coming? I mean, I know that, you know, we've made things, we've really kind of cracked down, but for those that really need the help, I mean, are they getting it?
No, they're not. I think that's the challenge. I mean, when we talk to colleagues of ours, either at International Rescue Committee, IRC, or Catholic Community Services, you know, they expressly are in the refugee space, and their funding was cut when the Trump administration said no more refugees, right? And so the challenge is, while there's no more refugees coming in, the folks that they have here that were being resettled, they lost the funding to continue to support those folks for 18 months on a path to self-sufficiency. So they're trying to support what few refugee, you know, members are here. The challenge with the immigrant population, and I mean, it's been a big issue of late, is, you know, the folks who were here, whether they were Venezuelan, you know, Afghani, whoever, I mean, because of all the changes in the immigration system. So the Venezuelans lost their temporary protective status, TPS. They've also lost their employment authorization documents, right? So, like, the workforce that's here, that has migrated here to have a better life, are not now having status to be able to do what they came here to do, which is basically to make a better life, send money back home, figure out what they could do, right? And so it's just, quite honestly, Leslie, it's just a hot mess. I mean, and it's and on a daily basis. I can tell you something now, and the situation can change in 3 hours, right? And it's just so hard to predict. And part of the challenge, too, I was trying to look up data to be able to provide you local information or data, and, you know, and touching base with colleagues of ours at Wasatch Immigration Project, too. And the problem is, right now, ICE is not forthcoming with information, right? So we're dependent on anecdotal stories. We're dependent on what do we hear, what do we see, kind of on our neighborhood watches, what do people know. But it's all anecdotal, and it's hard to validate it with facts.
Yeah. So what are we seeing? I mean, so what's happening to those refugees who have kind of lost that status and funding?
You know, those agencies, those other, our sister nonprofits, they're trying. They're doing their own, obviously, probably Giving Tuesday to try and help and support refugee, you know, the refugees that are here. We continue, like I said, I mean, separate of all the craziness that's going on in immigration now, we still, you know, stand in solidarity with the immigrant community that we serve. We're still continuing, you know, to do as much as we can in that legal space with folks, with our DOJs and our attorneys, right? We're still doing massive amounts and growing, you know, in the mental health space because there's just so much fear and anxiety and just stress among our immigrant families, right? And then really just, you know, still trying to support our young families that are, you know, moms that are pregnant, that are, you know, don't have family members here, that are really just trying to, again, make a better life for themselves.
Yeah, and how are you able to help, say, with some of those mental health challenges?
So, again, it's like we have a counseling team now of 8. That's the largest we've ever been in the 8 years that I've been there. And we could probably use 4 or 5 more folks, and we still would have a wait list, right? Right now, our Wasatch Back wait list is, our therapists are full. And so it's like about an 8-week wait list, but we're doing psychoeducation groups and things like emotional regulation, support kind of programs to allow folks to kind of come into a group setting and get some skill building and training before their turn to do individual therapy, right? So, it's just massive now. And I think what's interesting is we traditionally worked with just, you know, survivors of DV. And what we're seeing is the need to help a lot of kids, junior high school kids, kids that are in mixed status families that are feeling the stress of what if I come home and my parents aren't there? What do I do? And then what if I've got to be responsible for my younger siblings and all of that kind of, I mean, issues kids should not have to be dealing with at this point in their lives, right? So it's just so much mental health support across the age span right now.
And then with regard to December 18th, anything special happen or anything?
We just continue to hold strong to, again, our conviction as an agency that's going to walk in solidarity with, you know, our immigrant community. And we don't have anything major planned. But again, like I said, I think we definitely support the Sisters of the Holy Cross corporate stand, and we're here to be that sort of trusted entity to support folks on whatever their journey is, right? However we can help them, even if it means to tell them what their options aren't, right? Just so that they don't get exploited by somebody who says, give me $10,000 and I can get you something, when in reality they can't.
Yeah, and you see that quite a
bit,
huh?
We see that quite a bit, right. Yeah, with just, and it's sad, but there are folks called notarios that will just say, hey, give me $10,000 and I'll get you a visa. And they just take their money and run, yeah. And folks are so desperate that they're hopeful, right? They want to be hopeful and say, maybe this person can. And so, I mean, that's truly one of the legacies of Sister Kathleen, who was one of our immigration attorneys, who always said, I'll tell you what we can do, and I'll tell you what we can't, because I don't want you to be exploited.
Yeah. Have you had more success, though, getting people the permits, the visas that they need?
You know, we are the largest U visa provider, so working with folks who are victims of crime. The challenge now is there is such a backlog at USCIS that they are only now completing applications that we filed in 2017. And applications that we are filing now, they are telling us will take 15 to 20 years to be adjudicated. So it really puts people in a kind of limbo space right now, yeah.
And in the meantime, what happens?
Well, in the meantime, they do end up with a status, so they're in process, right? So that's okay currently, unless the administration decides to change that.
Yeah. Okay.
But as of right now, they're okay.
Anything else, Andy? Emmy, wanted to mention?
No, again, just I would just keep in mind all the nonprofits that are helping the immigrant community. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously Holy Cross Ministries, but everyone. And also on Migrants Day, you know, do an unexpected act of kindness for somebody you know who's from another country. It doesn't matter what economic echelon they're in. Just remind them that they're welcome here.
Yeah, yeah, the welcome. I think just that compassion would be a wonderfully refreshing, hopeful message for our refugee and immigrant community.
Okay. Andy Sear, Emmy Gardner from Holy Cross Ministries, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Leslie.
Thank you.
We're on the phone now with an update from Utah Open Lands Executive Director Wendy Fisher. Good morning, Wendy.
Good morning, Leslie.
So you're down south today, closing on a new easement. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. Just yesterday, we worked with a great partner, the Canyonlands Field Institute, on protecting an iconic ranch on the entry corridor, really, to Castle Valley. So for those who know Castleton Tower or Parrot Mesa or have ever traveled on the LaSalle Loop Road, the Castle Rock Ranch is now protected forever under a conservation easement granted to Utah Open Lands and signed yesterday.
Yeah, how many acres are we talking about?
So it is over 150 acres. It's got amazing kind of emerald green pastoral fields. And then, of course, part of it is that iconic red rock backdrop.
Yeah. A private family here? I mean, is that how?
So the Canyonlands Field Institute actually, through the generosity of one of their donors, acquired the Castle Rock Ranch several years ago. And part of it is that the Canyonlands Field Institute, part of their mission is really to nurture and foster an awareness and an appreciation of the great outdoors for kids from all different backgrounds. And so they do lots of things to immerse kids in really tremendous landscapes and teaching them outdoor skills as well. And so that's part of what they had been using this ranch for. And as they look to the future, they really said, hey, you know, what aligns with our mission is ensuring that regardless of whether we continue to be the landowner of this property or not, this will forever be protected under a conservation easement. And so we actually began this process with them almost over a year ago and worked through a lot of different things. And now the land has a conservation easement on it to protect it forever. And I think kind of the icing on the cake is they also found a conservation-minded buyer who is now going to buy the ranch, actually purchased it yesterday as well, and will ensure that that ranch continues to be this open space, view shed, working landscape, all within the terms of the conservation easement. So it was a real win for the community and for any of us who feel that these amazing landscapes that really shape us are things that we should be protecting.
Yeah. Utah Open Lands also working in the Clark Ranch easement. This is just here at 248 and US 40. The exclusive negotiating agreement with the Alexander Company expired last month. So what does this mean going forward here?
Well, I think this has obviously been one of those projects that a lot of people have been watching. It is a project that what the recommendation from the Citizens Open Space Advisory Committee was to protect basically all but 10 acres of the property, recognizing that there could be a need for different municipal services and uses in the future for the 10 acres. And so as the city's been working to figure out what they wanted those municipal services to be, Utah Open Lands actually did the conservation easement management plan baseline. We've continued to walk every potential trail alignment on that property, and we've continued to monitor its conservation health, you know, waiting for the point where it could be protected. And so, yes, now what we see is, I know that at the last council meeting, the council was very much in favor of, unanimously, seeing the protection of the conservation easement as it was recommended by the COSAC group. I think there are all sorts of legalities that I'm not privy to that are still in process.
Yeah, so the 10 acres. I think what is so confusing for others is that somehow a 5-acre buffer got brought into the discussion. My understanding is that there was no development proposed for that additional 5 acres, but again, that is outside of what was agreed to originally. Is that what's causing all the confusion?
I think there are a couple of things going on, Leslie. I think you're absolutely right. The 5 acres was supposed to be a buffer, and in fact, there are ways to ensure that that property is protected through a deed restriction that actually Utah Open Lands could enforce, as we would be the holders of the conservation easement on the entire property. And I think that, you know, some of this might be in terms of the nuance of wanting a conservation easement on the entire property, but that 5-acre buffer was somewhat severed from the rest of the 344 acres.
So where do things go from here?
I think that, you know, even this week, staff is looking at how they can accomplish really both objectives. It's complicated. As we all know, affordable housing is something that I think that the community and across the nation, it's become an issue. And open space is really what contributes to our quality of life and the reason we just, you know, love living in these places. And so how do you accomplish both? And I think staff is trying to figure out how do they adhere to that recommendation from COSAC and bring something back to the council. So I think hopefully this week we'll find out whether or not this makes it on a council agenda before the end of the year.
All right. Speaking of agendas, conservation of the Lundeen Farm in Wasatch County will be discussed at tomorrow's Wasatch County Council meeting. It sounds like this could be moving forward after all.
Yes, we have to cross all the fingers and the toes on this one. I think it's been one of those projects that is really speaks to the heart of how hard these decisions are, and especially when you don't have all family members in alignment. I think the Lundeens deserve tremendous credit for the fact that they have continued to stave off lawsuits even so that they could ensure the protection of this property. And they still need the support of the community. And so we have now gotten to a new place with new agreements, and we are hoping we can see a path forward that satisfies really assuring that the community money that goes in ends up in a conservation easement, that we can satisfy the other family members, and that, you know, we get everything in place. So this has taken a long time, but conservation easements don't happen overnight. There's a lot that goes into it, and it's a tough and complex process, this one, more so than almost any other one I've ever worked on. Mm.
And then there's the Pear Tree Llama Ranch in Midway, which received some money from the state. Tell me about this.
So Katie and Jerry White are just such great landowners, and after actually the protection of the Kohler Dairy, they turned to Utah Open Lands to see if we could protect their property as well. And so when they made that decision, yes, let's move forward, our staff, Marissa Fenwick, our land protection director, started moving forward with trying to obtain funding. We have $1.5 million in commitment from open space monies from Midway and Wasatch County. Obviously, we're going to be working towards getting some federal funding and some private funding, but we also were very successful in what was a pretty competitive process at the state level for open space funds. But we were awarded just recently $200,000 towards the conservation easement on the Pear Tree Llama Ranch. And it's really a great project and includes at a point in the future a public trail that would be a great connection in the Midway area. And then the protection of that 37-acre ranch that supports the agricultural economy in the city of Midway.
All right. The Northfields project, sounds like you're nearing completion on this one as well.
Yeah, so we have a couple of projects in the Northfields. And Leslie, I just have to say, as you get to the end of the year, you kind of look back on where you started. And, you know, of course, we started in January with federal funds for projects that had been awarded federal funds were frozen. And so it really stopped the process for quite a while. And these landowners have been waiting. They've been waiting to place their land under a conservation easement. They made that first step of choosing to put it under protection. So you have the Flying A Ranch, the Giles property, and then also the Christian Mitchell property on the entry corridor to Midway, but it also is part of the North Fields. And both of those projects were awarded funding, but then that funding was frozen. When it was unfrozen, we started doing all of the due diligence. You need to go through all the various different reviews through the federal process. And then, of course, we ended up with a government shutdown. And what is exciting to us is there's really a large priority from NRCS, our great partner from a federal perspective, in wanting to see this across the finish line. So we really believe we're in within 60 days of getting at least the Giles property protected. It's going to take a little bit longer for the Christian Mitchell property.
Okay. Yeah, I also want to, this is not your your conservation easement that you're working on, but the Jordanal Ridge easement is just so unique. And I just wanted to ask you in terms of, have you seen something like this in terms of an easement, instead of being held by a third-party land trust, it's actually being held by the landowner and, in this case, Heber City?
You know, I think that's a great question, Leslie. And obviously, you know, I'm going to be biased. Utopian Lands has been doing this for 35 years, and we do think that land trusts are a great third party. We know what we're doing. One of the things that has been concerning to me, just in terms of time frame, is in order for a entity, whether it be a land trust or a city government, you need to, in order for them to be able to monitor appropriately, they need to have the benchmark, the measuring stick, if you will. They need to have the baseline documentation. I haven't been engaged in many of the conversations, but in the conversations that I have been engaged in, it seems like they've got some deadlines that are bearing down. And so it's really comes about, regardless of who holds it, can they abide by the terms of the conservation easement, ensure the protection, and are they going to be able to long-term look at this property and say, yep, we got the baseline documentation here, and yep, you know, things haven't changed. I believe wholeheartedly that the intent there is to ensure that the community trust and the community values are upheld, because, of course, you know, the development associated with it in part came about through the negotiation of that open space. So, I look at the intention, and that's part of what we hope happens. But, yeah, it is unique. It's not unheard of. There are cities and counties that can hold conservation easements. But a lot of the times that they choose to do a land trust is because we know what we're doing, and it is our sole mission. Cities have a lot that they have to contend with, infrastructure, you know, all sorts of services. But what land trust's main mission is to protect open space and to do it in perpetuity. So I think this is one that we'll all be watching. And I think that what I keep looking at is just making sure that the intention, which really began when this project came up for development, that the intention of that open space for the community is adhered to and protected in perpetuity.
Okay, I have just another minute, but I just wanted to quickly ask you, given the challenges this year, government shutdown and such, how does 2025 stack up in terms of open space saved with prior years?
I have to say that coming down to the end of the year and being able to put as many pieces of property under protection as we are doing, and a lot of those being donated easements, is really gratifying, and it shows to me, it demonstrates the importance that people place on these unique landscapes. I definitely think that in working with landowners on these projects, from the Lundins to the Giles to others, this stacks up as one of the tougher years, and you had to have a lot of faith, keeping the faith on this.
Okay. Wendy, anything else you wanted to mention real quick?
Just grateful for everybody that supports the organization, and also all the wonderful landowners we work with in the city and the county. Just been great, a great year from that perspective.
Okay, great to talk to you. Wendy, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Wendy Fisher, the Executive Director of Utah Open Lands.